Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Grambling. He is Connor Orr. That was Week 12. Almost all of Week 12. There's still a Monday game. We tape this thing on Sunday night before they play the Monday game. So apologies if something fascinating happened on Monday night and you're listening to the show on like Wednesday or around the Thanksgiving table.
Yeah, but that's your fault, you know? Get with it.
Kind of is.
We provide a daily slate of lineup of podcast content for you. You know, you're supposed to devour it all. You're supposed to breathlessly follow every one of our words.
I mean, we have to like come up with outlines for the show and then do the shows and record the shows. And Shelby Royson, our wonderful editor and producer, has to edit the things and put them out. All you have to do is listen to them.
Yeah,
you've really been dropping the ball if you haven't been doing that.
Just sucking up all of our thoughts, you know, just sitting there, living off the teat, you know.
And now that we've berated all of you, it's time to talk a little Week 12 football here. We're gonna talk Jason Garrett and fourth down decisions. We're gonna have plenty on what happened to the Raiders, what's happening to Carson Wentz. Lots of good stuff in Week 12. Interesting week. Definitely an interesting week, but we are starting Sunday night in what was, it was flexed into the Sunday night spot. It was such a good-looking matchup on paper coming in, and it was not a close game. It was a total blowout, 49ers 37, Packers 8. I will say, Packers defense, they hung in there. This was sort of an uphill battle for the 49ers offense in the first half, but when it boiled right down to it, this 49ers defense is, I still don't know if people realize how good they are. They are spectacular. They are, it's them and the Patriots are just on a different level right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're unbelievable. And, you know, I understand what people are saying around the league when you talk to them about the 49ers defense, and they say, well, yeah, they should be, because any team that devotes that much resources to one position group or one set of positions, really the defensive line for them, should be phenomenal and should be excellent. And Bosa is obviously on a different level. I think at one point this season probably deserved Defensive Player of the Year consideration, but this is more than just a collection of talent. This is an idea. Taking kind of that those traditional cover three concepts that Robert Saleh got in Seattle and elevating them into something that is potent enough to stop pretty much anything that we've seen in the NFL, and really impressive job tonight against Green Bay. I think silenced probably any remaining doubters that they have in terms of, well, this defense is just a one-trick pony or can only do certain things.
I know it was a lot of talk about, you know, schedules getting so tough for them, and they had an easy first half of the season schedule, and this is when they're really going to be tested, and they certainly passed this test with ease tonight. One thing I will point out, because we've talked plenty about this defense across our podcast and how the pass rush, the upgraded pass rush has really transformed what they are, and then obviously they just sort of gelled beautifully on the back end. But Akella Witherspoon is back, and he was having something of a renaissance this year. I know it's only his third season, but he was like, he showed flashes as a rookie, and it was like year two jump. Nope, he was just really bad year two, and then all of a sudden he came out year three and was fantastic. Then he got hurt and he was out, and Emmanuel Mosley stepped in, undrafted rookie, and just became a really solid player back there. And now Witherspoon is back, and all of a sudden they have like legitimate high end depth and talent at the cornerback spots. Obviously, Tart and Ward have been great at safety all year. They really haven't missed a beat without Quan Alexander at linebacker. It's just like you could look at a lot of teams and say, you know, okay, if Stephon Gilmore gets hurt for the Patriots, they might be in a little bit of trouble. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be terrible, but they might be in some trouble going forward. But there's just so much good young talent that has been coached up, especially in the secondary on this 49ers team now.
And the reason for that is that they're set up differently than other teams. And I think it's one of the advantages of having sort of that figurehead GM type role that they have, John Lynch, in, where it's not really like a GM picking players completely separate of a coaching staff, I would argue that this coaching staff probably has more say in the selection of players than in the acquisition of players than any other team outside of New England. I mean, these are direct to scheme players that, coaches see in college and get to evaluate at the combine and say, that guy's going to be perfect for exactly the one or two things that I need him to do. And it seems so simple, but 29 of the other franchises in the NFL don't work that way. And I think that's why the 49ers have done such a good job of quickly amassing all of this talent that works so well with what they want to do.
On the offensive side of the ball on Sunday night, George Kittle back in the lineup. They had missed him the last 2 weeks. When Kittle had that long, obviously he had a great first half, and then he had the long touchdown pass in the touchdown catch, the 61-yarder in the third quarter, late in the third quarter. That was sort of counterpunch to the Packers' one touchdown drive in this game. But man, it was like. It was shades of that Kyle Shanahan Falcons offense, the three tight end set, get all that heavy personnel in there, and then you get one of those tight ends deep, and he, you know, he faked that little flag route, turned it into to a post, and it was just it was a walk-in touchdown for them.
And a great job by Garoppolo there, and a great throw. I mean, that looks easy when we're looking at it on television, but to be able to roll one way, stop, pivot, set yourself, and then lead him like he did on that. I mean, that, you know, we've had concerns about Garoppolo's accuracy and decision making, and you know, everything that's sort of been picked apart throughout the beginning of this season, and you know, even up until this week, I think there's been some valid questions about Jimmy Garoppolo, the playmaker. But that's a tier one throw, and I think that that whole thing, like you said, is just sort of a paints a complete picture of an offense that's getting more dangerous as they go, and that's pretty scary, especially when you consider the fact that a lot of us, myself included, had them pegged for a little bit of a slowdown here as the season wanes.
Yeah, I don't know if it's like a matter of just getting confidence in that knee again, or maybe just shaking off some of the rust early in the year. And also, I always wonder, like, when you're winning games, your defense is dominating, you're winning games easily, and you're basically just handing the ball off 40 times a game. Does that have something of a slowing effect on a quarterback who might be coming back from a major injury? But you just look at this offense, and it's like, yes, Garoppolo is still the question mark here. That's what we all wonder about. But really, it's kind of like, how many teams out there? I mean, look at the Rams right now. How many teams just have like issues with basic functionality on offense? And that's not where the 49ers are when they have issues. They just it's like, you know, the occasional like erratic throw, and you know, missing high and wide when it comes to Garoppolo. But it's like the system still works. If the system is operated properly, and it usually is, they can kind of do whatever they want offensively.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, for the people who it's a great point for the people who are saying, well, this. Garoppolo this or Garoppolo that. I mean, there are no teams really anymore. That whole deal about that high-end quarterback or that top-tier quarterback is kind of slowly becoming a myth, and it's about what you're doing schematically and how that elevates the best players on your roster. And we've seen that in droves from the 49ers, and especially on a night like tonight where they just show so many different ways that they can beat you that makes it exceptionally hard to prepare for a team like that, because you almost have to go into a game assuming that you're going to get beat up in some capacity, and you have to choose which is going to be the best or the worst there.
The last thing I'll say about this 49ers offense is no Joe Staley in this game. And when Kyle Shanahan made the switch at left tackle, he started with Justin School, who had been filling in for Staley earlier this year. And they just ran Daniel Brunskill out there the same way you would, like, run a running back in there. It was just such a sort of, I don't know, there was no pomp and circumstance of this switch at left tackle that you'd think, you know, like, oh, they're struggling at left tackle. This is going to go horribly. It's going to be a total disaster. And they ran Brunskill out there, and it was just kind of fine. The dude who's just, like, on the bench, the journeyman who's filled in at right tackle for him this year, just sort of went in at left tackle, and it was like, yeah, this is going to be just going to go as well as it did.
It's amazing how that works with good teams, right? And then bad teams couch. Bad teams couch like a left tackle loss as if it's like a main blockage in one of their arteries. You know what I mean? But good teams find a way to overcome that stuff. And it goes back to your original point. The depth on this roster is phenomenal, but scheme specific. I think if you took a lot of these guys and put them somewhere else, they might not be as good as they are now. But collectively, this is a deep roster that is making one hell of a run.
As far as the Packers go, you can chalk this one up to one of those nights. The offensive line was just completely overwhelmed at the trenches. It doesn't happen to them often, but it did happen to them a couple of weeks ago against the Chargers, and I guess you know, it's some sort of Bosa curse going on here. But I feel like this was never really an issue with the Packers. And now we've seen it be a major issue in two times in the past month or so. And I don't know. I don't know if Rodgers is still at a point where he can do so much second reaction stuff and so much stuff out of structure that he can just single-handedly carry an offense.
Yeah, and I mean, especially not against this team. I mean, it's just not going to happen. The defensive line and pass rushers are not going to give you the time. But it's interesting. I mean, there are so many games where it seems like everything is moving forward and progressing with LaFleur and Rodgers, and then there are like moments like we saw tonight where, you know, LaFleur is trying to explain something to him at the end of the half, and Rodgers is just staring out into the distance like some sort of scorned lover, like he's never going to listen to LaFleur again. And it's like, this has got to be frustrating, I think, if you're LaFleur. You're the only coach out of this massive new coaching class that's actually working out and doing things to push this forward. It was such a difficult job to come into. I think it's great. Yeah. I think Rodgers needs to give him a little bit of a break, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and look, he might. It's so hard to read Aaron, or maybe it's really easy to read Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, too easy to read Aaron Rodgers.
Maybe that's the issue. Maybe we just need to recalibrate what the body language is. Like, if he's staring off into the middle distance when he's being instructed, maybe he's actually just absorbing everything. That's just his face for intent concentration on what you're saying.
This is his "I'm enjoying this" face, right?
Yes. Yeah.
This is his "you're right, coach" face.
This was indeed an ugly night, though, for the Packers offense. 1 for 15 on third down.
And wow!
That was when Tim Boyle was in there at quarterback, and it was literally that like second to last play of the game when Jamal Williams ran for like 12 yards on a 3rd and 9, and that was it.
Aaron Rodgers and Derek Carr sat for a combined 20 minutes tonight. Wow! Who would have thought?
And
the NFL in Week 12, just a wacky one.
It was, and we got plenty to talk about. We will talk about that Raiders collapse. One of us can't wait to talk about that Raiders collapse. We've also got, like I said, we're going to talk Cowboys. We're going to talk about Garrett's unfortunate decision. Stephon Gilmore basically just leaving everyone in the dust as far as the defensive player of the year race. Lots to talk about in Week 12. Stick with us. All right, we're back. Let's run down the afternoon action here now, and we're gonna start with the big one, Patriots 13, Cowboys 9. Jason Garrett, man, I don't know. I mean, I don't coach a professional football team. I feel like I have no pressure on me when it comes to these decisions. But down 13-6, late in the game, less than 7 minutes to go, at the Patriots 11, facing a 4th and 7. He takes the field goal, and they end up losing 13-9. That was their last chance.
The problem started way before that, though, if you think about it, right, for Jason Garrett, because he's never going to go for it on fourth down in that situation. He's the most risk-averse coach in football, and so what happens there is if you know you're not going to go for it on fourth down, that affects your play calling on first down in that situation, second down. You could have run the ball with your best offensive player on third down if you knew you were going for it on fourth down, but instead, what you're doing is treating third down like it's the complete end of your possibility to move the ball forward, and you put yourself in situations like this. And I wish that the New York Times fourth down bot was still alive. Today is the kind of day that we really miss it. But Jason Garrett's going to get a lesson in analytics, I guarantee you, because Jerry Jones was not happy after this one, and I think it's all going to come back to that particular moment.
Well, it's funny. A year ago, on that Sunday night game in Philadelphia, where he was very conservative on fourth downs, and it seemed like maybe that was a lesson learned, and it would be different going forward. He did get more aggressive. Or I'm sorry, it was the Houston game when they lost to the Texans. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And he got more aggressive on fourth down going forward, and this was not it. And like you said, they were telegraphing it almost when they threw on second down, threw on third down, and it was just kind of like, well, they're going to kick this field goal, aren't they?
It's totally bizarre to me, too, because never mind the odds. Let's say if you are totally against analytics and the science behind why this makes sense to go for it, just in the in-game situation, how many times am I going to get this close to the end zone?
Yeah.
And versus how much time is left in the game, and then you take into consideration the score differential, what does getting within four get you there? I mean, it made zero sense to me, no matter how many different ways you play that out going forward.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And I always say, you know, it's more than just the win probability line chart that you have to look at there. You know, do I have a play in my pocket? Or like you said, will I get down here again? And to that point, really the only play the Cowboys had made on offense, really the only play they made all game, was that 59-yard catch and run by Randall Cobb that set up that eventual field goal there. To think they were going to get back down there in this game seemed outrageously optimistic, shall we say.
Yeah, and you make a good point, and I want to belabor the fact that I don't think every coach is going to be John Harbaugh or should be John Harbaugh. I'm not saying that. I mean, and there are always situations where, you know, there's just stuff that we don't know, right? So, like, you know, we may never find out that, like, oh, Dak Prescott thought he broke his hand on that drive, or there's mm-hmm. always these situational things that we don't find out that go into this, but Jason Garrett serially ignores, you know, yeah. these common sense decisions, and so that takes him away from one of those things where he could actually have an excuse here.
It was a thrill for anyone who took the Cowboys and the points, though, because that ended up being a good day for them. But
and
if you're trying to win a football game, didn't work out so well.
And I think a good day for Patriots fans, because in better weather, I think you're going to have a better N'Keal Harry breakout game. That was a good touchdown. You know, I mean, he showed kind of his skill there in being
yep.
able to box out a defender and just make that first round pick catch, right? To be able to out-muscle, out-athletic somebody and bring down a catch in the end zone like that. That's a good sign moving forward that at least they can diversify their offense a little bit. And,
yeah.
you know, I think he's going to be big, I think, over these last few weeks.
I think so, too. And look, that was Byron Jones he beat on that play. So that's a big-time cornerback, and it's obviously a big-time catch in the red zone. And you know, they lack a lot of things offensively that they used to have, but one of the things they really miss is that, you know, that Gronk red zone factor, not to mention the James Devlin red zone factor, where you can also just line up with your two backs and slam it in there. But that was a big-time play from Harry, and it really was. I mean, that was a completely 100% typical N'Keal Harry play that you would have seen at Arizona State from him.
Yep.
So nice to see him getting going. as far as the Cowboys offense goes, this was, you know, Dak was up and down. Like I said, really the Randall Cobb long catch and run is all they really had going. And there's not necessarily any shame in that. I mean, obviously this Patriots defense is outstanding, and rain and wind in Foxborough today. So it was tough to get going. But this was another game where Amari Cooper goes up against a number one cornerback, and kind of like back when they lost in New Orleans early in the season, Cooper gets taken out of the game, and it really has a domino effect on the entire offense where they just can't get anything going consistently in the passing game here.
It's incredible that what branding will do for someone's legacy, that we're not talking about Stephon Gilmore like we've been talking about Darrelle Revis in 2009, 2010, really 2008, 2009, 2010. I mean, he is taking away your most important offensive player, and it just, you know, taking him completely off the field, and it's incredible. And I was glad that it was Devin McCourty, I think, that said that after the game, that, like, you know, we have the best cornerback in football, and people need to start paying more attention to that. Arjenny Vrentas did a wonderful story on him, especially, mm-hmm. you know, quarterbacks are more successful in terms of quarterback rating if they would just throw the ball into the dirt on every play than to throw it at Stephon Gilmore this season, which is pretty incredible. But we don't hear about that. And the fact that he continually does this week in and week out to shut Amari Cooper down this week, it really shows how not one-dimensional Dallas is, but, you know, leaning towards one dimensional at least.
Yeah, and getting back to Gilmore real quick, so Amari Cooper, zero catches. Gilmore had more catches than Cooper did. He had an interception that set up one of those Nick Folk field goals. On top of that, we saw during that ill-fated chip shot field goal series that the Cowboys had, that second down play, that was Gilmore falling off Amari Cooper to break up what would have been a touchdown to Jason Witten. I mean, he is the defensive player of the year. I thought it was an interesting race in my head between Gilmore and Lattimore until Marshon Lattimore got hurt. To me, I don't see how you can objectively vote for anyone besides Stephon Gilmore at this point for Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, I don't think it's even close. I mean, he's, like you said, he's running away with it, and it has allowed the Patriots to do everything that they've done this year, and it's pretty incredible that we're talking about how far behind the offense is lacking, but that this is still really a historically great defense that only couldn't handle Lamar Jackson, really, this season, and as mm-hmm. everyone that listens to this podcast knows, the Patriots actually know how to beat the Ravens, but they're just saving it. They've stashed away the game plan, so...
One more note on this one. Nick Folk missed a couple of kicks in this one for the Patriots. He's their third kicker of the year. Missed from 46, missed from 48. Again, bad weather, but January in Foxborough, they get some weather there. So all I'm saying is Cody Parkey is out there. Just sign him, you cowards.
All he did was get a kick blocked in the playoffs last year, and then go on the Today Show to talk about he got over it. It wasn't even his fault.
You know, he kept hitting the upright. Hitting the upright super close. You're not that far away. Yeah. It's off the upright.
It's just give Cody Parkey a chance.
There you go. That's all I want. That's all I want this January is redemption for Cody Parkey. Speaking of kicker problems. Well, let's start with the kicker success in Saints-Panthers.
Yeah, let's say a good thing about a kicker.
Yeah. Saints 34, Panthers 31. Will Lutz connects on the short field goal to win it 33 yards. Saints survive in this one. I know a lot of us were sort of looking at the Panthers, and they were sort of a dead man walking type of team at this point. They had been so brutal last week in losing to Atlanta, and Kyle Allen was done. And we kind of looked at the Saints team that also, by the way, got de-pantsed by the Falcons in the past 2 weeks. No Marshon Lattimore in this one. And this is kind of what we expected might happen to them when they faced the Bucs last week, but didn't. They just didn't play very well defensively. I think it's a relative torching by Kyle Allen, but still, they made Kyle Allen look pretty good, and they allowed the Panthers to put up a lot of points in this one.
I was surprised at how much they were able to just remain in this game. And obviously Christian McCaffrey plays a large role in that, but there's some things that he can't do. I mean, he, you know, he's obviously just one component of this team. And yeah, credit to Kyle Allen. I mean, you know, and this entire staff, I mean, when someone like Cam Newton goes down, you don't really have a great idea to replace him because he's the most unique player athletically you might have in NFL history, you know? And so it's not like it's just like, okay, we're going to find somebody else to run this offense. But I think they've done a good job in sort of making the parts work around Kyle Allen, but the Saints are just so deep, I think, offensively, that it's hard to get into a position where you have to score with them like the Panthers did today.
Yeah, this was, I mean, look, Michael Thomas was dominant again in this one.
Jared Cook, too. Great game for
him. Jared Cook coming up. We all kind of forgot about it. I think everyone was expecting that Jared Cook breakout because they're always saying, like, wow, Drew Brees up the seam to a tight end. If they could only, like, get someone better than Kobe Fleener to play that spot, this guy's going to light it up. And Jared Cook is obviously a talented guy, but it hadn't really happened until, like, the last 2 weeks. I mean, he was tremendous in this game.
Yeah, really good, and you know, like athletic plays too. I mean, you know, going up and grabbing stuff out of the air. The kind of player that they used to have, that Drew Brees is, you know, Michael Thomas is obviously an athletic sort of outlier, but Jared Cook is becoming that at the tight end position. We've sort of seen the position itself sort of compress a little bit. There aren't really that many great outlier players there, but he's working his way toward that. But one thing that I did notice during this game too, that's worth mentioning, is how much better Sean Payton is that almost any other coach at using his best player as a decoy to open up other things on the offense. And if you watch the way that Carolina's defense would snap two defenders, or sometimes two and a shaded defender against Michael Thomas, and then what happens immediately behind him or in the area that the defenders are taken away from, it's incredible. And I'm like, every down he's doing that, and still gets Michael Thomas 100 yards and a touchdown every game. It shows that there's so little excuse out there for people like Freddie Kitchens and Odell Beckham or some of these other number one wide receivers that don't play as well every week.
Yeah, I was going to say, and if you're saying it's offensive line, the Saints are actually down two offensive line now. Yeah. Teron Armstead injured his ankle in this game, so the entire left side of their offensive line is completely blown up right now, and they're still getting it done here. Joey Sly, rookie kicker for the Panthers, had a rough one. He missed two PATs, and then he missed a 28-yarder. Marcus Davenport did hurdle the center and was bearing down on him on the 28-yard miss. I guess as a kicker, you know, you do have to kind of kick it around the 6'7" guy who's like 5 feet away from you. But this was a rough one for Sly.
Yeah, that's what you get 4 years ago for 3 years ago for cutting Harrison Butker. Right?
Yeah.
Because now he's buttkick.com, man. Now he's just crushing it with the Chiefs. You don't cut butt kick. But
you don't.
Yeah.
You don't. You do, and then you rue the day.
Speaking of officiating in this game, how rich was it that the Panthers, of all people, got a pass interference call overturned? The rule that Peyton created that has caused us all such indigestion this season.
I was going to say, and if you were going to, it was on a third down, on a third and goal. It was either a third and goal or it was inside the 10 at that point. It's a third down, and that call, if you were to chart all the challenged pass interference calls this year, that one would definitely be like middle of the pack. I didn't think there was any chance I was getting overturned.
Yeah, and it was incredible. I mean, you know, to see his reaction afterwards, and he has been so vocal about this throughout, but like never with the sort of perspective that like, hey, I kind of helped screw this up, right? You know, like I helped shove this thing through, and you know, he's the one that's out there, you know, saying, well, it's not what we were promised in the room. This is exactly what you were promised in the room. Mm-hmm. But the problem is nobody ever told any of these officials the definition of a horrible mistake. And we're seeing this play week in and week out. It's absolute theater. It's I hated it at first because I thought it was ridiculous, but now I love it because it's just, you know, we're using technology to reintroduce the human element of refereeing, which is like the most ass backwards thing you could possibly do. It's amazing.
It's I can't wait to see what they come up with this this offseason when the competition committee gets gets together with their little bowls of hotel frosted flakes and decide what they're going to do with this rule next.
It's going to be amazing.
It was absolutely delicious irony until Sly missed that kick and it was like, ah, well. So then it, I mean, look, if the Panthers ended up winning the game after that call, I mean, I don't know what would have happened. It's all we would have heard about for like the next 3 months. So
if the Panthers won that game after that call, if I was Al Riveron, I would immediately retire and use my ample career earnings to purchase a nondescript house in the French countryside and never come back, because Sean Payton would be mad enough to find you wherever you are. Like, he would be that upset.
All right, let's go up to Philly. Seahawks 17, Eagles 9. And look, this Eagles offense, we knew it was going to be ugly considering what they're running out there as a receiving core. No Nelson Agholor, no Alshon Jeffrey in this one. Greg Ward, the former University of Houston quarterback, was probably Wentz's most reliable target in this one. But it seems to be having an effect on Carson Wentz beyond just, okay, well, no one's open, so now I have to throw it away or take a sack. When guys are open, he is just all over the place with his accuracy right now. And it is that, I just think psychologically, when you so rarely have a window to throw into and so rarely have an open target to connect with, my nonsensical metaphor is always, if you took a dartboard and like remove the entire dartboard except for the bullseye and then ask someone to just throw that dartboard, it would just mess with their head after a while, because obviously you're going to miss again and again and again. And I feel like that's where Wentz is right now, is there is absolutely no place for him to throw the ball. And then when there actually is a place for him to throw the ball, he just, whether you call it lack of confidence or whatever it might be, he is just spraying the ball all over the place.
Yeah, and think about kind of where everything was in his development in terms of, you know, when he was coming up and becoming this ascending star was when the Eagles were one of the first teams to adopt a lot of the run pass option stuff that he was running at mm-hmm. North Dakota. They got it from North Dakota State's playbook. I mean, they admitted that they took it from there when they were scouting him and looking at him in college. And so when you're running plays that literally NFL defenses aren't built to stop, your concept of open, is different, I think, over your first 2 years than it is now. And you're totally right. It just seems, he seems rattled. And I think that everyone will point to that one video that's become sort of the viral clip from that game, is that running back sort of swing or that wheel route out of the backfield. And he just skied it like 30 feet over his head. And, you know, he said it wasn't the wind. He said, you know, and didn't blame it on the wind or anything like that. It's just, he's missing that. And if I'm Doug Peterson, you know, I feel good that I have a quarterback as your head coach, a guy who can kind of connect with him on a mental level there and try to bring him back down. But, you know, something's got to give. But miraculously, thanks to Jason Garrett, they're still right in the thick of the playoff race. And like, this team is systematically coming undone and the Cowboys cannot put them away.
They are, yeah, let's talk about the playoff picture right now, because obviously in the NFC East, you're probably only going to get one team. You're almost certainly only going to get one team.
I hope so.
Cowboys are 6-5, Eagles are 5-6. And I hate to be a schedule watcher here, though, but Cowboys will get the Bills at home on Thanksgiving. They have to go to Chicago the next week. And look, whatever you think of the Bears, and you think the Bears are not very good, I'm sure, but it's tough to play at Soldier Field. It's always difficult to play there, and especially the way we've seen this offense kind of have some issues on the road over the last two seasons, that's a dangerous matchup. Then they host the Rams, and then they go to Philadelphia, Week 16. And look, the Eagles on the other side of this, they kind of got their difficult schedule out of the way. And by the way, Dallas wraps up at home against Washington, which you figure is a win. But the Eagles next week, they'll go to Miami, then they'll host the Giants, then they'll go to Washington, and then they host the Cowboys, and then they go to East Rutherford to play the Giants in Week 17. Eagles have a whole lot of winnable games down the stretch here, and again, if they hold court at home against the Cowboys, they're going to win this division. They're going to go to the playoffs.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, that Soldier Field game is going to be super tough for Dallas. By then, the Bears will be running a quarterback-agnostic offense spearheaded by, like, you know, Tariq Cohen. He'll just be running the Wildcat the entire time, and it'll be very hard to stop in the winter on the road, you know. So, yeah, it's really incredible that they've allowed themselves to get into this spot to begin with, given the start that they had. If you're anybody on that team, I mean, you have to do a little bit of long-term planning here and look at things and say, we got to put our foot on the accelerator, or I hate to go back to what we keep complaining about at the top of the show, but if you have a chance to beat the Patriots on the road, beat the Patriots on the road. Come on.
Yeah.
You know, let's treat this with a little urgency.
Getting back to the Eagles, I guess the good news is you're going to get, you know, these are not season-ending injuries, you don't think. Lane Johnson was out for this one, and Andre Dillard filled in for him, and the first-round rookie. I don't know if it was a matter of going left side to right side, but he was terrible in this game. You know, with all the problems with the receiving core, to not be able to protect Wentz either is just a, I don't know. I don't know what you call it. It's doubly bad, I guess. It's just two bad things, and then Wentz not being able to throw the ball is also bad, but...
It's like you said, it's not bad in comparison, because as we've talked about it at the top of the show, at the beginning, you know, there are other quarterbacks that are doing better in worse situations, but this is all new to Wentz specifically, right? And so he's going to have to find his way out of this, like all quarterbacks, good quarterbacks do. And I think he's got the tools for it, but it's a matter of whether there's the kind of that mental thing that'll get him through this too.
I know. At some point, they're going to have Lane Johnson. They'll have Aguilar back. They'll have Alshon Jeffrey back. And I'm not saying that sarcastically. They'll have Aguilar back. Aguilar is still he adds some sort of big play ability.
Aguilar is fine.
They absolutely don't have. Yeah.
Aguilar is
absolutely
fine. Yeah.
Absolutely. So they'll get those guys back. They got a chance to get right in Miami, and you know, they got a chance. They still have a chance to do this thing. Other side of this though, the Seahawks and hey. Connor Orr was driving the Seahawks bandwagon early in the year by himself. No one in that bus. And here they are. They're sitting at 9-2. To me, they are just a completely bizarre team. I had said a year ago when everyone was ready to write them off, I said, you still got Russell Wilson, you still got Bobby Wagner. But even coming into this year, I just didn't expect much of them. And I can't really figure out week to week how they're winning games, because it's so ugly. But it's kind of their style now. And again, they're undefeated on the road. They're 9-2 right now. You can't really argue with that.
Josh Gordon coming up big on some third downs there is kind of a nice little dependable outlet receiver. The DK Metcalf regression is coming. I know this, you know, it's going to happen. And he did drop some balls today.
Couple of bad drops.
Yeah. And so that's coming. And so the offense, I think, will come back to earth a little bit. But as Pete Carroll said after the game, Russell Wilson, first quarterback in NFL history to start his career with, eight straight winning seasons.
There you go.
Big.
Brady's never had it. I question that stat. Unless you're saying Brady, counting Brady's rookie season when he didn't play.
Yeah. I think he gets banged for that first season there. Yeah.
Always get banged for that Bledsoe season.
Poor Brady, one record that he's not going to have walk away with. There's nothing you can do about it.
when will Pete Carroll respect Tom Brady? That's my question. Yeah, Seahawks 9-2. I wrote about it in my Sunday morning column. The red zone stuff seems to be a little bit outliery to me. But also the fumble stuff that they get, and they picked up three more fumble turnovers in this one, and two of them were just really strange plays. One where Dallas Goedert was downfield 15 yards and got stuck in a crowd, and they ripped it away from him as they brought down. Wasn't too weird, but there was one where Rasheem Green was literally sitting on his ass. He was out of the play. And Wentz just sort of like backed into him, and Green was like, oh, wait, there's the football, and just like swatted it away. And it's like, How does that happen? Who does that?
I love when this happens, and I've covered, you know, as a beat writer, a lot of really good defensive teams that seem to kind of be whatever the lot that I fell into. And every time that would happen, you know, the defense would adopt this nickname, and they'd be like, oh, we're the thieves, or we're the hound dogs, and this is our identity. And I'm like, it's not an identity. It's just an immense statistical, like, fuck up that somehow, you know, you're getting an abnormally large amount of lucky turnovers and grabbing all these loose fumbles, and at the end of the season when all this stuff comes back to the mean, you know, or to the middle, it's gonna hurt you because you're relying on these statistical anomalies. And, you know, that's part of it here. I don't know,
it's gonna be interesting. Again, they played 11 games, they've won 9 of them, and that's really all that matters right now.
I parlayed that Super Bowl prediction into a lot of, you know, not only are the Seahawks going to win the Super Bowl, but this is going to be a huge Brian Schottenheimer vindication season. Just you wait and see. It's all coming. It's all happening.
Brian Schottenheimer just going to have his choice of jobs next year. Go out to New England and push Belichick out.
That's funny.
We say that, but we were really talking up Scangarello, and I still believe in Scangarello, but they had a long one in Denver. We'll get to that in a second in the lightning round. But we gotta talk about the game you were at watching live today, Connor. Jets 34, Raiders 3, and we talked about trap game for the Raiders. Jets are looking a lot better. They really settled down here. And you know, if you were gonna look at this before the season, you'd probably say the Jets were probably a more talented team than the Raiders. Will the Jets steal one? And they didn't just steal one. This was a lopsided game. I mean, that score is completely indicative of what happened.
If you believe Jamal Adams, too, it was all Raiders fans' fault. That's what he said after the game. It was so funny because, you know, I think that Adam Gase and Joe Douglas have done a great job of sort of, I called it like chaos, chaos agnostic, or whatever you want to call it, locker room, where Jets teams historically have been such at the whim of the market, where the highs are so much higher and the lows are so much lower. But that Dolphins loss didn't destroy them, and I think that they've done such a good job on sort of a very steady emotional level at keeping this team at sort of an even keel, and today showed that, because, you know, the Raiders were a better team, they're a more talented team, and Gase had a better game plan, but that led to something crazy where they ended up throttling them. But yeah, Jamal Adams said that they were so hyped up for this because there are more Raiders fans there during pregame warmups, and they booed the Jets as they came out onto the field. But it really did sound like a road game for the Jets because it was super loud and super noticeable from up in the press box. But apparently that motivated them to the point where they beat them by 31 points.
So that's all it took. Had you just stayed quiet, that was probably the Raiders' win. Yeah. It is a little bit bizarre that to have the lame duck team from the other side of the country, and obviously I know the Raiders have classically had one of the fan bases that travel best, so it's not that bizarre. But this is a lame duck team from the other side of the country coming into your building and doing a little bit of a takeover.
Yeah, no, it was crazy. It was funny because you could tell. I was Eric Gruden's post-game press conference, and you could tell the fan thing was going to be a big part of his post-game speech, but then it ended up just being a massive apology to all the Raiders fans that were there. But it was really interesting. I mean, Gruden had sort of his set list of complaints that his schedule sucks, which it does, and he mentioned that again, and he mentioned the weather, but I don't know. I mean, I think there's no excuse for the way that you got exposed by, you know, Ty Montgomery and Robbie Anderson, essentially, on defense. And, you know, I also don't think there's an excuse for sitting Derek Carr for the entire fourth quarter. I thought that was unbelievable. And he said after the game that, you know, he's like, I know I'm going to get killed for this. But nobody really grilled him for it. But I think that's, if I'm a Raiders fan, that's alarming to me. If you don't think that your team can come back in that situation against the Jets, that is alarming to me. There's 15 minutes left in the game. Anything could happen in 15 minutes.
It was unusual. It was unusual to see the white flag waved at that point. But again, unlikely they were going to come back. I guess if you're going by the analytics of can we come back from 31 points down in this one.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that factored into it was he was playing Greg Williams, and Greg Williams did not stop blitzing until the very godforsaken end of that game. And so I do understand it from that perspective, where Derek Carr was probably facing like an 8-man rush every single time he was going to drop back for the fourth quarter. But you know, have some faith in your boy there. You know, let it happen. At least give him a couple series.
Boy. Jamal Adams, I'm so glad they get. I think Robbie Anderson is an absolute stud. Jamal Adams is obviously a great player. I'm just glad they hung on to those guys. I know they're gonna finish like 6-10 and no one will care, but I'm glad they didn't tear it down. Those are young guys. They're gonna be there for like, if you want them, they're there for like another 5 or 6 years. Keep them, build around them. Jets Super Bowl champions, Super Bowl 55.
And Sam Darnold continues this incredible stretch where sometimes he looks like the best quarterback in football. There are nights when he's just excellent, and today was another one of those days where he looked great. But I agree with you. I'm glad they held on to Robbie Anderson. Definitely glad they held on to Jamal Adams. Like a couple of these other teams we've been talking about, schedule really lightens up here. They get Bengals and Dolphins, who I know have been a problem for the Jets in the past. So it's not a guaranteed victory, but you'd like to think that the newly giving up Dolphins, again, who are now tanking even more aggressively than they have before, will probably lay down to this Jets team on the road at home in the winter. So,
yeah, that's 3 straight weeks of 34 points for the Jets. That's weird and impressive.
And they're doing it with, I think I heard an interesting stat today that they've gone through at least their first two players on the depth chart at every single offensive line position this season. Think about that. They've gone through their first and second string option at every single offensive line position, and they're still here. You know, you compare that with a team like the Colts, who's had the same offensive line for basically the entire season, and what a luxury that is for a team. You know, I that means a lot. So
that is wild. Before we get to the lightning round, though, I want to throw this out. Let's just look at the sixth seed. Let's pencil in. You can't pencil in anyone.
You love the idea of the Jets. You can't let go of the idea of the Jets sneaking into the playoffs. I love it.
They're so close.
The sixth seed right now is Pittsburgh, right? It would be Pittsburgh, right?
Sixth seed is Pittsburgh. So let's put the Bills in as the 5 seed, even though they're 8-3. Anything can happen. And let's ignore the Texans for now. They're 7-4. Let's say they win the AFC South. So you have the Steelers 6-5, and then you have the Raiders, Colts, and Titans also at 6-5. You have the Browns at 5-6, and the Jets at 4-7. And when you're handicapping this, I think I still like the Colts, even though Titans have a really tough schedule down the stretch. And I'm just kind of looking. I think the Steelers are. We'll get to them in a second, but I think this is not going to go well for them. Do you still put the Raiders? I mean, how do you feel about the Raiders at this point? They go to Kansas City next week to face the Chiefs. You figure, especially a rested and healthier Chiefs, you figure that's going to be trouble for them. And then you look at the rest of the schedule. You know, home dates with the Titans and Jaguars, and they go to Chargers and Denver. Those are all winnable games in the general sense.
There's nothing more dangerous than a YOLO, I know I'm going to get fired, Doug Marrone. So dangerous, right? You know, that's a team I don't want to run into. No, but I think the Raiders, if the Raiders had beat the Jets today, they would have had close to about a 70% chance of making the playoffs, which is significant. Yeah. I mean, that's high. And we lost to the Jets today. I think I checked 538 before I filed from the stadium. They're down to about 20% now. So, I mean, they still have a 1-5 chance, which isn't outrageous. But, I mean, they significantly strayed off course today. And this was a win that they had to have, and they didn't get it.
All right, let's open the lightning round. And I wish I had said lame duck Raiders before we started the lightning round. Then I could have just transitioned so beautifully to new Steelers franchise quarterback Duck Hodges coming on for it. It was, Mason Rudolph just wasn't cutting it. I don't know how else you can put it at this point. I thought he showed some flashes in the Rams win, and I emphasize flashes. Like, he made a couple throws where it was like the Trubisky grading scale, where it was like, all right, there were like two or three plays in there that were pretty legitimate NFL quarterback plays, and everything else has just been a mess with him. They finally pulled the plug. Cleveland coming up next week, so I'm sure Commissioner Goodell is plenty happy at the prospect of Mason Rudolph not playing in that game. But Delvin Hodges comes in, basically makes one throw. James Washington on a deep crosser, and then James Washington just literally put poor B.W. Webb on his butt.
What a
play that was,
yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, it was – B.W. Webb was also the guy who fell down on that reverse flea flicker thing against the Rams. B.W. Webb has very much starred as the pratfalling Washington general in some of these top highlights of 2019. But ends up being a 79-yard touchdown for James Washington at a time when Steelers were trailing this game 7-3 going into halftime, and they had absolutely nothing going offensively. And really, ultimately, that James Washington touchdown was all they had going offensively in this one, but that was enough. 16-10 victory. I guess the question is now, to me, Duck Hodges has to start next week just because he made a throw as opposed to no throws.
Yeah, I think that him and Mason Rudolph, it's interesting because when you transition between passers, you normally try to stack your depth chart where guys have sort of a comparable ball or at least something that's, you know, familiar for wide receivers, but they're completely different. I feel like Duck Hodges has a lot more touch on his passes, whereas Rudolph is a lot more of a timing, sort of a fastball kind of guy. And so it's really interesting that maybe Hodges gives you a better chance to make some of those plays like that happened today, where you put a little air under the ball, you give your receiver time to go get it and track the ball down, and you know, maybe that's where they're trying to go here. But yeah, I mean, talk about sort of the conspiracy from on high here, that it's just super ideal to not have Rudolph on the field this week. I mean, Goodell is probably just like singing right now. He's probably so happy.
I say, whatever the Dolphins do when someone loses every year, the 72 Dolphins, that's what Roger Goodell was doing when Duck Hodges took the field. Titans 42, Jaguars 20. Derrick Henry runs wild, as he does every once in a while against the Jaguars. Look, obviously, decisive win for the Titans, who really pulled away in the second half. At one point, Henry had scored two touchdowns in like a 16-second span because the Jaguars fumbled the ensuing kickoff after a 70-something-yard touchdown run. But Titans just quietly hanging around, 6-5, Tannehill, something of a steadying presence for the offense. And then the defense hasn't quite put it all together, but they still have a chance to be a really good defense. They're still so good on the back end. Jeffrey Simmons is back. You're seeing a little more from Harold Landry at this point. I really like this team. I hate the schedule they have to play down the stretch. It is a tough schedule, but I think if I were sort of sizing up all the teams here among the AFC wildcard contenders, I think I like the Titans the best.
They're just perpetually like the team, you know. It's just like the, you know, and it's the team that you can't overlook ever. And they're just this constant speed bump. And I guess that's credit to Mike Vrabel. I mean, you're playing with basically Ryan Tannehill and whatever else you have going on. I mean, Derrick Henry can be an absolute hammer in some of these games when he's going and he gets enough touches. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I don't want to play this team. After a certain point in November, they're tough to beat in those situations. They have good players in the back end defensively, and it's enough to make what happened today sort of scary for any team. I mean, not just the Jaguars, but any team that hopes to come in and try to play their style of offense against the Titans.
Bills 20, Broncos 3. I'm going to fight against every fiber of my being and shortchange the Bills here, except to say Tre'Davious White really got the better of Cortland Sutton, and I think Cortland Sutton's a rising star in this league. White was, once again, absolutely fantastic. Bills are sitting there at 8-3, but we'll talk about the Broncos a little bit. Brandon Allen was, like a lot of quarterbacks are when they go up to Orchard Park, not good, overwhelmed in this game. Ends up, the stat line was every bit as ugly as his actual performance. 10 for 25, 82 yards, interception, took 4 sacks. If Drew Lock and the Broncos have sort of been hinting that Drew Lock might be ready to see some action, I mean, this is the time to do it right now.
Yeah, especially, I mean, if you're Vic Fangio, if you're this coaching staff, you'd like to lay out a little bit of your idea for the future. We all know that John Elway is sort of less than reasonable in the patience department, and you're going to have to eventually show ownership that, like, hey, this is the plan here. I mean, we do have something going on, and you and I have talked about this weeks before. I mean, Rich Scangarello has done a good job with what he's been given. We've seen guys like Noah Fant emerging, and, you know, to have Brandon Allen play as well as he has, I think, deserves some mentioning. But there's going to need to be more than that to hang your hat on, because this is a veteran team. This isn't a team that's bottoming out because they're depleted talent-wise. This is a team with a lot of older, experienced players.
Bucks 35, Falcons 22. Jameis gets off to a shaky start, couple of early interceptions, but then sort of turns it on. And Chris Godwin also made a couple of ridiculous plays as he emerges as sort of a next level star. But the Falcons looked an awful lot like they did in the first half of the season, and that Dan Quinn revival. I don't know. This was a worrisome development.
Yeah, I think this one probably did it for Dan Quinn. Sadly, one of the NFL's good guys, no doubt about it. Someone who I think just, I mean, unfortunately just could never get back to where that team was at peak, kind of Kyle Shanahan, that Super Bowl season where they had everything rolling for them. But yeah, I don't think he's getting another opportunity to turn this around. The Falcons are going to have to get super aggressive in the offseason to maximize that rapidly closing window with Matt Ryan and Julio Jones and some of their players on defense. And so, yeah, it's unfortunate because I think that the team really does like him, and I think they do play for him, but there's just something essential, whatever it is, that is missing from this team.
Yeah, the offense was shaky in this one, and the secondary looked as bad as it did early in the year as far as just blown coverages and whatnot. They'll probably beat the Saints like 56-0 on Thanksgiving right now.
Absolutely.
That we've proclaimed Dan Quinn done. Washington gets the win. Dwayne Haskins is a winner. 19-16 over the Lions. Haskins was pretty bad in this game, but he did deliver a big throw after they got a late interception of Jeff Driskel, and Haskins set up with a throw to Terry McLaurin after he had kind of missed a couple of potential game winners to McLaurin during this game. But they end up getting it. Dustin Hopkins kicks a couple of field goals in the final minutes to get the 19-16 victory. And I don't know. Look, winning games is good. Just win games right now and get some sort of sense of optimism going here if you are working for Dan Snyder right now.
Bill Callahan is slowly creeping away from rebound boyfriend status to long-term partner status here as he's slowly working his way in. The Bill Callahan era has already begun, and Dwayne Haskins missed the final play of the game, the victory formation kneel down, when he was taking selfies on the sideline. It was so funny to watch Terry Bradshaw implode from the inside while he was reading the highlights of that on Fox. Thank God they didn't give him time to talk about it. You do you, Dwayne Haskins. You know, nobody needs to be out there for that play anyway. Anyone can do that.
It was absolutely fine. I had no problem with that. Though the weird thing, and look, these are all very minor offenses, but the weirdest thing was after that throw to set up the game-winning field goal, there were 20 seconds left. They had a timeout left. They were going to run out the field goal team at the Lions 21. It was a 39-yard attempt. But they used a timeout immediately with 20 seconds left, which meant they kicked the field goal, and then there's 16 seconds left, and they still have to play defense for a couple final plays. Obviously, it worked out fine. It was likely going to work out fine, but it was just like, well, why'd you just do that if you were like, just run it down to 3 seconds, and then you can leave after kicking that field goal. Then you don't have to worry about Terry Bradshaw getting mad at you.
There is a entire episode to be done on this, but the difference in success rate between coaches who have someone just handling this game decision minutia and then just telling them what to do versus the guys that think that they can handle everything and do it themselves is staggering. It's staggering. It's an ego thing. Just let the kid in the press box that knows how to do everything tell you exactly what to do. They can think more clearly in this situation. Just give up a little bit of your power and everything will be fine.
The dudes who play Madden, that's right. What they do better than most NFL head coaches.
That's right.
Bears 19, Giants 14. Bears about to go on maybe a little winning streak here. They'll go to Detroit on Thanksgiving Day, and then we're seeing what is happening of Detroit without Matthew Stafford. They're going to end up getting the Staffordless Lions twice this year. Talk about some softening up of that schedule. But in this one, Khalil Mack shows up. Trubisky, Trubisky put together like two drives where you would think that things are going to be maybe kind of okay with him, and then through one shaky interception and one really bad interception to let the Giants hang around, and Daniel Jones just refuses to take care of the ball. He's just not going to do it.
It's remarkable that I think that's one of the traits that Dave Gettleman looks for. That's what blew him away at the Senior Bowl was. He must have saw a strip sack fumble and been like, this is exactly what I saw when I scouted Eli Manning all these years ago. I love losing the football at unpredictable moments during the game. It just makes me feel alive. But good for the Bears. You know, they needed a little bit of good juju, especially the fact that I think they made the right decision in trotting Mitch Trubisky back out there and giving him another shot, and they get the win. On the other hand, Pat Shurmur, I think, sealed his fate tonight. I think that's about it. Time to turn the lights off. Oh yeah, I think he had a chance to salvage that, but he is so much worse than Ben McAdoo was. And so Ben, if you're listening, you know, finally someone says something nice about you. You did a better job as a Giants head coach.
I like Daniel Jones. I love the fact that he hangs in the pocket for so long, and it really does give those receivers an extra half second to sort of open up. But he's got to take care of the ball when he's back there. It's like there's a such thing as being too cool in the pocket. It's like you got to remember, like, oh, those guys, they're trying to take the ball from you, and everybody knows it now.
At least that is something that you learn and develop, whereas, you know, you can draft quarterbacks sometimes, and you see the first few series, and you're like, oh, I'll never be able to fix that ever, and this is terrible. Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things that he will grow into. It's the thing that I think probably saves Gettleman, but eventually foils Shurmur, is that like the Giants say, okay, you can pick a quarterback, you can build some of this stuff, but we need somebody else to call the plays here. This is getting pretty disastrous.
And finally, Browns 41, Dolphins 24. Browns get to break out all of those touchdown celebrations they've been saving up all year with all the Super Bowl stuff. I mean, they are, as we discussed earlier, they are going to the playoffs. They're sitting at 5-6 now, and they're gonna keep on beating up on these softies left on the schedule. But this was it. We talked about it on the Thursday show, where it was like, you know, this is Baker's chance to really run up some numbers here, and Freddie Kitchen's chance to sort of be like, ah, look at this guy's stat line in the end. It wasn't so bad, was it? So they roll up 467 yards of offense on Miami. Baker throws for 327 and three touchdowns. Jarvis Landry, 148. Beckham goes for 84 and a touchdown. All is right in Cleveland. It was always right.
Yeah, you know, and they showed how difficult I think they can be. Now, they let Miami get back into this game a little bit. I think they had some defensive lapses there, especially in the second half. But I think how difficult they can be if they get like a 2-score lead on you, especially now with the combination of Chubb and Kareem Hunt, where you essentially have no fatigue in the backfield and you have two above average backs that take care of the football. And Hunt, they've done a good job, I think, of establishing as a little bit of a pseudo third down back or your gadget guy as well, and so you can put both of them on the field at the same time. So they've shown some interesting stuff, but it's more than window dressing. There's an effectiveness to it. There's something where they can, you know, grind out wins too if they need to. So it'll be interesting going on the stretch with them.
All right, we've grinded out another show. It's gonna be a wrap, Connor.
Good to do it with you, Gary. This was fun.
Always good, always fun. We'll have a bit of an abbreviated lineup this week for the MMQB podcast. A couple shows missing, a couple shows coming earlier than usual, but it's Thanksgiving, so enjoy time with your family.
Yeah, don't listen.
Get together.
Don't listen to us.
Get together.
Let's get some.
Well,
turkey.
I figure you'll want to listen to all these shows with your family, but now you know figure you'll drift off at some point in like hour three. So
I would love the idea of a classic like Norman Rockwellian Thanksgiving dinner where everybody's crowded around the iPhone listening to you and I break down Russell Wilson's MVP candidacy. I love that.
The old-timey radio. Someone must have invented that already. The sort of old-timey radio speaker that you can hook up your iPhone to and just listen to stuff that way.
And torture,
seems like something everyone in Brooklyn would have.
Torture all your kids instead of like the nightly news. It's going to be like a really bad true crime podcast. we don't have our kids don't have a chance. Poor people.
No, they don't. The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Connor Orr and me, Gary Gremling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Ravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. Now, while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.